Ladies and gentlemen, is this microphone alive? Can you hear me? Thank you. In 1961, Mr. John Danz, owner of motion picture theaters and a philanthropist in the Northwest, and his wife made a gift to the University of Washington, a major gift intended to enable the university to bring to the campus each year distinguished scholars of international reputation who have, quote, concerned themselves with the impact of science and philosophy on man's perception of a rational universe. Mr. Danz was born in Bryansk, Russia in 1877 and brought to the United States by his parents when he was only 4 years old. He worked in Portland and San Francisco as a newsboy and as a rancher in Nevada. Came to Seattle in his 20s, engaged in the clothing business, and then entered the motion picture business. His formal education was limited, but he was widely and liberally self-educated, interested in liberal religious movements, especially interested in humanism. He himself organized the Humanist Society of Washington. For years, Mr. Danz contemplated the possibilities of making a significant gift to the university that would enhance its academic programs. At about this time, the academic world was celebrating the centennial anniversary of the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species. Mr. Danz appreciated the fact that Darwin's theory of evolution had once been widely resisted and even in places rejected, but that gradually it became accepted and 100 years later was acknowledged to be a milestone of scientific thought. In 1961, shortly before he died, Mr. Danz suggested informally the bringing of Sir Julian Huxley to the campus as the first John Danz lecturer. There followed in the subsequent years the distinguished series of speakers whose names appear on the back of your program. The John Danz Fund, I think, will be a perpetual reminder of the generosity and vision of one of Seattle's distinguished citizens, his wife, and his family. Mr. Danz's wife and some other members of his family are here in the audience this evening. Present John Danz lecturer, Sir Isaiah Berlin, is described at length in another page of the program. I will not go over any of this, save to offer a few brief corrections with apologies from the university for some clerical errors. Sir Isaiah Berlin, for example, he tells me is a former professor of social and political theory, because it is not possible to be a professor and a president of a college at the same time. He was also born in 1909 rather than 1906. We have restored 3 years to his life. And he is a vice president of the British Academy rather than the past president. I believe in other respects the information is correct. His books include Karl Marx, Historical Inevitability, later republished with an additional introduction in a book on liberty, and the most famous book, The Hedgehog and the Fox. I would like to think that Mr. Danz, for whom surely one picture was worth a thousand words, perhaps in time came to appreciate the fact that for historians, it is possible that one word is worth a thousand pictures. In consequence, it is, I think, appropriate that his bequest provide us a chance to hear an historian. The only thing I would care to say really about Sir Isaiah Berlin as an historian at this point, since I think anything else I say would be superfluous, is that in reading what he has written, in hearing what he has said, one is immediately struck with the extraordinary care and precision with which he uses words. I can convey this no more appropriately than by reading simply the last few lines of The Hedgehog and the Fox, which was a study of the life, the thoughts, and the artistry of Leo Tolstoy. Tolstoy's sense of reality, Professor Berlin has written, was until the end too devastating to be compatible with any moral ideal which he was able to construct out of the fragments into which his intellect shivered the world. And he dedicated all of his vast strength of mind and will to the lifelong denial of this fact. At once insanely proud and filled with self-hatred, omniscient and doubting everything, cold and violently passionate, contemptuous and self-abasing, tormented and detached, surrounded by an adoring family, by devoted followers, by the admiration of the entire civilized world, and yet almost wholly isolated, he is the most tragic of the great writers, a desperate old man beyond human aid, wandering self-blinded at Colonus. Professor Berlin's subject is the assault on the French Enlightenment. Monday evening, he talked to us about Herder and historical criticism, suggested that the Enlightenment represented one of the greatest shifts in world thought and philosophy, and that it underwent a systematic critique and assault from the Romantic school. And on Monday evening, he showed us how this happened through one of the first Romantics, the historian Herder. This evening, his topic, in the second lecture of the three, is Kant and individual autonomy. I give you Sir Isaiah Berlin.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I thank Professor Pease for his very kind words about me, and above all for the corrections in the document which I'm afraid made me both older and more distinguished than in fact I turn out to be. Corrections on both points are most welcome. This evening I want to talk about Kant in connection with the assault on the Enlightenment. At first, this may seem to be an extremely paradoxical sort of theme, because Kant rightly is thought to be a hyper-rationalist figure dedicated to precision of thought, rigor, dedication to logic, minute and severe argument, and an enemy of everything that was vague, misty, confused, and above all, romantic. Kant himself detested even such romanticism as occurred towards the end of the late 18th century. He reserves some of his sternest words of disapproval for various persons whom he regards as Schwärmer, I mean people who with some kind of confused, enthusiastic longing for the infinite and so forth. He was a man of rigorous thought, as I say, and dedicated to the defense and explanation of the natural sciences, of which he was a great, on which he was a great expert, being a considerable cosmologist himself, and an analyst of unsurpassed acuteness and importance. It's therefore, there's something rather paradoxical, therefore, about putting him into this particular, on this particular galère. Nevertheless, I hope I shall make good the particular claim which I make. Kant, of course, is a great, in a sense the greatest figure in modern philosophy. I don't wish to enlarge on that. He was the first person, perhaps, to state quite clearly what is the true subject matter of philosophy and to distinguish it both from the sciences on the one hand and logic and mathematics on the other, and certainly from the ordinary findings of common sense. But this is not the aspect of him on which I propose to dwell. I propose to dwell on his moral philosophy, and not really on the whole of that, but only on those aspects of it which led to the huge revolution about which I am speaking. He did, of course, accept the triumph of the sciences completely. He dedicated himself to an analysis of why the findings of science are certain and to be believed against the attacks upon this very view of, for example, Hume, who thought that the premises on which the sciences rested were those of mere undemonstrable belief. But, and he, as I said above, he had a peculiar loathing of everything which was occult, everything which was irrational, which was wandering through the century. And let me tell you, one ought to say about the 18th century that although normally one thinks of it as a century of reason, century of rationalism, century of elegance and symmetry, underneath this glassy surface, which is usually presented to us by the historians of taste, the historians of art, and indeed some historians of thought also, underneath this surface there was a great deal that was turbulent, confused, occult, and violent. In the second half of the 18th century, there began to wander, particularly through Eastern Europe, but parts of Western Europe as well, all kinds of mystagogues, all kinds of preachers, all kinds of messiahs with and without beards, all kinds of persons who represented themselves as Christs on earth of various sorts. Some of them were harmless and rather mad, others committed crimes. This is the century of Mesmer, the century of Cagliostro, the century in which there was a great deal of table turning by all kinds of distinguished people, by the King of Sweden and the King of Denmark and the Duchess of Devonshire and the Vicomte de Rohan. It's not as smooth and as quiet and as rational and as symmetrical as all that. And if you ask why this happened, in part it happened because whenever public thought takes on too severely rational, almost pedantically rationalist a turn, the darker forces, the unconscious forces, which undoubtedly stir through the minds of mankind, seek some kind of outlet and break out in all kinds of fashions. This is certainly what happened in ancient Greece. The rationalist philosophy of Aristotle, the rationalist philosophy of the Stoics, was more or less simultaneous with all kinds of mystery cults, all kinds of searches for the irrational of the darkest and most mysterious kind. And this is, roughly speaking, what began happening towards the end of the 18th century. For example, the rise of Swedenborg and the Swedenborgian religion is a typical symptom of the outbreak of what might be called unconsciously irrational forces against the excessive tyranny of scientific rationalism. Kant hated all this, tried to refute it, attacked it. Why then should I regard him as being responsible for some of these things? Well, while, of course, he was, as I say, a rigorous rationalist and believed in the findings of the sciences, this was only one aspect of him. There was something curious as schizophrenic about him as a thinker. Because in the realms of moral philosophy, he was, like Herder, brought up by the Pietists. And as I think I tried to point out last time, Pietists in Germany were a sect of Protestants, driven in upon themselves by, if you like, the humiliations and the provincialism of Germany, who believed in the inner light, who above all believed in constant soul-searching, constant searching one's own conscience, in absolute dedication to the constant reading of the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, constant self-questioning of their own motives. They disbelieved in ritual, they were not interested in learning, they were mainly interested in distinguishing right from wrong, in living upright lives. They were weighed down by a sense of sin, by the sense of corruption which goes through everything human, which they largely derived from the preachings of Luther and his followers. This led, no doubt, to a great deal of hypocrisy too, but it led also to a great deal of severe discipline and lucidity and clarity of thought. Both Herder and Kant, although they disagreed with each other, were disciples of these men. Kant disliked Herder because he thought his generalizations were too large and too vague. He disliked him because he thought that all these huge historical generalizations were not founded on enough evidence. The method was not scrupulous enough. He also disliked Herder because he thought that Herder paid too little attention to logic, to reasoning, that both his style and his outlook were too turbid, too turbulent. No doubt interesting and suggestive, but philosophically much too confused, ever to be useful in the rational progress of mankind. Herder, on the other hand, didn't like Kant because he thought he was too pedantic, too severe, because he chopped everything up into categories, because he distinguished between reason and imagination, imagination and understanding, understanding and intuition, intuition and perception, perception and sensation. All these things for Herder were artificial divisions put in by a lot of dry pedants. Man was one, his body and his soul were one. Imagination overflowed into reason, reason overflowed into intuition, intuition overflowed into perception. These artificial barriers inside human beings, just like the artificial barriers inside society, were simply instituted by a lot of dry-souled pedants who didn't understand the unity either of men or of groups or of nations. In short, they had no sympathy for each other, and they wrote extremely disagreeable reviews of each other's works. They were, roughly speaking, contemporaries. They were born and died within a few years of each other. They both came from East Prussia, they both came from Königsberg, which was no doubt the absolute seat, or the heart of the Pietist doctrine. And both, in a certain sense, revolted against certain aspects of the Enlightenment. As I think I said last time, it was a very backward part of Germany, and the sudden introduction by Frederick the Great, who was a French-speaking enlightened despot, of a lot of cold and contemptuous French officials who spoke French and looked down upon these poor German hicks as a lot of totally uneducated countrymen, totally unable to understand either how to conduct life or any of the new arts and sciences for which France was proud, produced a natural revolt on the part of these unfortunate people and produced a good deal of fairly acute xenophobia, which Herder gave himself with enthusiasm, while Kant, in his more modest way, tried to resist it and tried to find everything that was good in them. But it affected both men. Now, let me come back to Kant's pietist upbringing. One of the great principles, of course, of pietism was the view that man can choose between right and wrong and chooses between them freely and is only meritorious if, in this choice, he makes the right kind of choice. They were not interested in good and evil, at least not so much. If good was to be defined in terms of what human beings desired or what made human beings happy, which was a general view of the 18th century, happiness was the last goal for which they were seeking. Man was not here for happiness. This was the veil of tears. He was oppressed, in any case, by a thousand ills. All he could do was to save his soul by following his conscience in all circumstances and resisting evil, no matter how great the pressure put upon him, either by men or by circumstances. This Kant imbibed from his teacher Knudsen and believed all his life. Consequently, morality was something in which he believed very fervently. Now, he argued that if man was to be moral, that is to say, if he was to be praised and blamed, praised for his right acts and blamed for his wrong acts, the implication of this was that he could choose between them. If he could choose, only if he could choose, could he be regarded as responsible for them. Responsibility therefore implies freedom of choice. If I choose to do what I do, not because I am free to choose between them, but because I am conditioned to do so by whatever it may be, by education, by my passions, by the behavior of my body, by the pressure upon me of my society, by any kind of force, whether the external forces of nature or the forces of nurture or education, or as I say, my own emotions, if I am in fact conditioned to do this, if I am simply an object in nature, like stones and animals, who cannot help acting as I do, so that some men are generous because they can't help being generous, and others are mean because they can't help being mean, how then can praise and blame be rationally used? And yet, one of the things which he believed in most fervently was that the one thing which all men could do was to choose between right and wrong. In fact, he had begun by thinking that moral choices were dictated by some degree of expertise, that as in chemistry, as in physics, as in mathematics, you had to have a certain degree of, if you like, education or knowledge in order to be able to choose what was right from what was wrong, what was your duty from what was not. But on reading Rousseau's Emile, which is one work by Rousseau which made a profound impression upon him, much more than Social Contract, on reading Rousseau's Emile, which we are told was the only thing which ever made him miss his daily walk to his lecture, so that he was positively late for his lecture, which is an unheard of thing in Königsberg, because the citizens of Königsberg, it is well known, set their watches by Kant's walk, daily methodical walk to his morning lectures, and he lectured every day, excluding Sundays, I suppose. When he read Emile, having missed his lecture on this occasion, it was because Rousseau had convinced him that in moral matters, all men are experts. There is no need for expertise. No man ignores, if he is sane at all, ignores the difference between right and wrong. He may be mistaken about what he thinks right, and he may be mistaken about what he thinks wrong, but he knows the difference. If a man suddenly says to you, I used to know the difference between right and wrong, but I'm afraid I've forgotten it, it's not very likely that you'll believe him. And this is a proposition which Kant accepted wholeheartedly. Now, if this was so, if all men could do this, and if you discovered a man of whom you could say that he didn't know the difference in right and wrong, you rightly judged him to be in some way not quite sane, not responsible for his acts, and you would be liable to send him to hospital rather than prison for what he did. If this was so, then surely it followed for him that men, however hemmed in they might be by this or that causal factor, must at least have a limited degree of freedom, at least to be able to choose what is right, or at least refrain from choosing what is wrong. This seems simple enough. But all kinds of revolutionary consequences followed. How can I be free? I cannot control the external world. The external world rolls on its way, whatever I may do. I have very little power over that. I cannot even control the acts of other men. What can I control? I cannot be responsible for being happy. Whether I'm happy or not does not lie in my power. This lies in the power of a great many factors over which I plainly have no control. What can I control? As I said last time, what is this inner self which the tyrant can't touch, which circumstances cannot break? There must be some inner light within me which is free from interference. And this inner light guides me to the difference between right and wrong, which in all circumstances can be followed. Now, this entails that only those acts are moral which proceed from me, of which I am the author, which I choose, and not that which I am chosen for, so to speak, which other men choose me for, or circumstances choose me for. That which I initiate, which I am the author of, not something which conditions me, which guides me. And therefore, the whole French view of the many of the encyclopedists, that men are as they are because they're made of the particular flesh and blood and bone and tissue of which they're made, live in the periods in which they do, are brought up in the places in which they are, the influence of climate, the influence of geography, the influence of economic factors, the influence of social factors, of educational factors, all these things which shape me as I am must be ignored in order to make room for that particle of freedom, so to speak, that small space within which I'm able freely to choose. I must be the author of my acts. In fact, if I am as wholly conditioned as Helvetius thought me to be, or as Holbach thought me to be, or as a good many of the other French encyclopedists under the influence of the new natural sciences thought me to be, in what sense can I be said to act at all, rather than be acted upon? In what sense am I the author? Any more than, so to speak, the knife which the murderer uses. Godwin, somewhat later, said, a man is no more responsible for murder than the knife which he uses. He is just as conditioned by nature to do what he does as the knife in his hands is conditioned to do what it does by the impulsion of the wrist. This is something which Kant plainly found unacceptable. The notion that human beings are in that sense robots, in that sense objects, playthings of forces outside them, he regarded as refuted by the direct moral evidence of the notions of right and wrong, by the fact that every man knew in choosing that this was a primary datum. This could not be an illusion any more than the perception of the external world could be a total illusion. It was just as primary a datum and needed to be met. But clearly, this wasn't wholly compatible with the scientific doctrines which the French encyclopedists were preaching, according to which men were just as determined, just as conditioned as everything else in a causally determined nature. Now, the first freedom, of course, which Kant talks about, is freedom from men. There is a little essay by him, which is called Was ist Aufklärung? What is Enlightenment? In which he makes this point very clear. He speaks of human autonomy, that is to say, being conditioned by myself, being the author of my own acts. In fact, the very notion of action as something which is different from mere behavior. If somebody pushes my elbow, I am behaving. If I act, if I choose, and all men are choosers, and that is how they differ from the rest of nature, if men are choosers, then I am autonomous. If whatever in me is not under my control, my digestive system, the circulation of my blood, various other things which affect my body in a way in which I can't altogether control, that is called heteronomy. That is to say, being conditioned by causal factors outside me. Now, if I am made to do what I am by somebody else, no matter how well-intentioned, this is to deprive me of some primary human quality, and is a form of oppression, is a form of humiliation, is a form of degradation. Let me read a quotation. There are all kinds of things which Kant disliked very much. He disliked cruelty, he disliked ignorance, he disliked indolence, he disliked all kinds of things which the Enlightenment preached against. He disliked superstition, he disliked prejudice. All these things he disliked with just as much fervor as the most illuminated, the most enlightened of the French philosophers. But there is something which he disliked even more, and that is the notion of paternalism. A paternalist government, said Kant, and I'm now quoting, a paternalist government based on the benevolence of a ruler who treats his subjects as ungrown-up children is the greatest conceivable despotism and destroys all freedom. This was quite a dangerous thing to say in the kingdom of Frederick the Great. who, so to speak, prided himself on his benevolent paternalism. This is precisely what the regime was proudest of. Nevertheless, Kant's inveighing against this is one of his most salient characteristics. To be treated as a child is like being treated as an animal. It's like being treated a horse being trained for a circus. It's being treated like a canary. No matter how benevolent the tyrant, no matter how good his intentions, the idea of treating human beings as not being responsible was the greatest insult which you could offer to their humanity. Better for Kant to perform evil acts freely than to be conditioned into a smooth performance of nothing but good ones. Now, you see, this really is not going to be compatible with what, for example, Helvetius taught. For Helvetius, I think I tried to say last time, what you wanted was to produce a rational society. How did you do it? Well, men were very corrupt, and they were ignorant, and they were victims of superstition, and they were victims of deception. Therefore, you treated them with sticks and carrots. You had to re-educate them. Re-education meant you rewarded them for good acts, and you punished them for bad ones, and so you gradually conditioned them into being good citizens, and you prevented what might be called antisocial behavior. This, for Kant, was an absolute nightmare. The idea of having a lot of men manipulated by some other men, no matter what their intentions were, into jumping through certain hoops, no matter how desirable the route through these hoops was, or how rich the reward, or how happy they might become, was to destroy their very humanity. Happiness was not the goal. God has indeed made man into a very imperfect instrument if happiness was to be his goal, said Kant. And therefore, the enemy was the French utilitarians, the French philosophers. They were the enemy because they mistook what was human in man. And what was human in man was the freedom of his will. What was human in man was his power to choose. That's what made him a man. Now, the whole notion, for example, with which we're today familiar, of, for example, exploitation, which, after all, has had quite a career as a concept, is really something which begins with him. You may ask yourself, what is wrong with exploitation? Why shouldn't I use somebody else for the purpose of doing something which may not be wicked or criminal at all? I use people for the purpose, perhaps, of making them happy or of making other people happy. I send them on errands. I force them. I may have to force them sometimes if they're recalcitrant or obstinate into doing all kinds of acts which will end in the good of society. For Kant to make anyone do something which is not something which he himself has clearly willed to do, to make him the instrument of my will, no matter how benevolent my intentions, is to rob him of his humanity. That's what he calls exploitation. Therefore, to use people for ends which are not their ends, to bring up people in such a way that their acts do not proceed from their purposes but from mine, is exploitation, degradation, humiliation, dehumanization. These are all the things which are talked about now, so to speak, as the result of the actions, let us say, of tyrants or of the state or of the bourgeois order or whatever it might be. But the whole notion, so to speak, that exploitation is the greatest evil which you can inflict upon another human being. It's some form of enslavement. It's some form of degradation. It's molding him. It's sending him on. It's treating him not as a human being, but as a child, or worse still, as an animal. Really dates from the passionate sermons on the subject of the severe rationalist Kant. This is so far as human beings are concerned. And here he echoes, I dare say, Rousseau. Rousseau, was almost the first person to say, the man who stands in dependence on another man is no longer a man. He is nothing but the possession of another man. Rousseau was a man whose whole life was the preaching of independence of others. Men mustn't depend on each other. Dependence on others created bullying on the part of some and flattery and groveling on the part of others. It made men perform functions and play roles and play parts which did not spring from their own clear moral perceptions of what it was that their natures cried for, but meant they accepted all kinds of scales of moral value from other people which they tried to serve in order simply not to be destroyed or to be bullied by these others, or in order to conform. But even Rousseau said, and let me quote you again, he said, I think something like this. He said, the nature of things does not madness, only ill will does. Well, that's what Rousseau said, and that is what the French believe, that only human ill will is what maddens you, the nature of things we accept. The French thought this, the Italians thought it, and the English thought it. But there was one nation which did not think it, and that is the Germans. Not only the ill will of human beings, but even nature appeared to them to be an obstacle to moral freedom. And this is really quite a new note in European thought. Not entirely new, because it's to be found in the ancient world as well. But certainly if it was known, it was forgotten. Nature, you must understand, in the 18th century is treated on the whole with respect and benevolence. Nature is of harmony, divine harmony. Nature is an organism, nature is a mechanism. Nature is a hierarchy, nature is an orchestra, nature is a pyramid. There are all kinds of views of nature. But it's always conceived of as a kind of model or ideal. And men go wrong when they break away from her, when they behave in a manner which might be called unnatural in some way. And the important thing is to return them to the bosom of nature. Even Hume, that profound skeptic, thought that if men behaved in some unreasonable fashion, nature, like a sort of kindly doctor, would restore them to themselves if only they leant upon her and allowed themselves to be brought back to sanity and health by Mother Nature. Mother Nature, Mistress Nature, Dame Nature. Nature's apron strings to which we are tied. Nature is always spoken of with extreme benevolence in the 18th century as being, on the whole, as I say, a kind of model which we ought to follow, an ideal which in some way we ought to understand and adjust ourselves to. Not so Kant. Let me offer you some quotations. Personality, said Kant. By this I mean freedom and independence of the mechanism of nature. If I am the plaything of nature, if causal forces which operate on trees and stones and animals operate on me too, how can I be said to be free? And he said in a desperate sort of way, he felt trapped in a kind of cage, because you see, you must understand that as a philosopher of science, as a man who tried to explain the external world and its workings, he was perhaps the greatest, most convincing defender of the most rigid causality in nature, and thought any deviation from that was mere irrationalism. But that applies only to external nature. That is what I mean by saying there was a certain division inside Kant. But this mustn't extend to men. If, he says, appearances, by appearances meant the external world, what we see, what we smell, what we feel. If appearances were real things, things in themselves, freedom cannot be saved. Well, perhaps they were real. Perhaps all there was the world as a kind of tremendous treadmill in which one thing followed another with an absolute rigorous necessity. If that was so, it was no use talking about morality. At least, not about the kind of morality in which choice was possible. You could praise people for being beautiful. They couldn't help that any more than they could help having blood in their veins. You could praise people being generous. Perhaps they couldn't help that either if they were born that way. You could praise people for all kinds of qualities which they had in the way in which trees had qualities, in which animals had qualities. But if you were going to praise a man for making an act of choice which he could have desisted from doing something which he needn't have done, the very idea that a man needn't do something, that you can say to a man, you shouldn't have done that because you could have avoided it, the very notion of could have is not applicable to a causally, rigidly determined nature for him. And that is why he says, in his voluntary acts, man is free and raised above natural necessity. Already Shaftesbury, at the beginning of the 18th century, had said, man is not a tiger strongly chained, or a monkey under the influence of a whip. Original native liberty gives us the privilege of ourselves and makes us our own. But I don't think Shaftesbury developed this idea, he just said it as a self-evident truth, but didn't proceed to elaborate it in any particular fashion. But for Kant, this was the heart and palladium of his entire system. Let me go on quoting from Kant. If, he says, our freedom is simply that of a projectile, which of course could think it was free from the propulsion by which it flies, If we were like a clock, which once wound up, could claim to run on its own motive power, then our freedom would simply be that of a mere turnspit. Some people try to get out of this dilemma by saying, well, all we need be afraid of is external causation, simply the acts upon us of some kind of dead inhuman nature, which try to condition us, but we are not. We act in accordance with our character. Our character is our own. If a man performs a good deed, it's because he's a nice man. If a man performs a bad deed, it's because he has a corrupt nature. He does it, certainly, because he chooses to do it. It's only his choice which is not free. His choice is conditioned by something, by his constitution, by his nature, by his character. But having chosen, of course, he can either do it or not do it. For Kant, this was not good enough. This is called the self-determinist theory of freedom, which is, in fact, the most commonly accepted view, even among philosophers today. For Kant, the notion that all man wanted to do was to feel free from some kind of cold, brutal, external pressure upon him of forces of a cold and indifferent nature. But provided you assured a man that he acted in character, provided you assured a man that his behavior was predictable, but predictable from his own qualities, not the qualities of something else, he felt quite happy, quite reassured. Kant denied this with extreme ferocity. He said, to try and put on character what we've now removed from nature and try and save the situation in that way is nothing but a miserable subterfuge. That was his particular phrase for this particular view. Now, if in fact this is so, if man is free, for Kant, of course, there is a dilemma. On the one hand, there is the external world to which also the human body belongs. But there is a dualism, there is something which is called the soul, the spirit, the human will above all, which is in some sense free and soars above this and in some way erupts into the causal chain, erupts from outside and alters its direction. There is some kind of free-swinging activity here. Exactly the same applies to his ethics. Why do we do what we do? It isn't the case, as previous thinkers have thought, that there are certain purposes which we can't help aspiring to. That, for example, there are certain goals which human beings are born to seek for and cannot help seeking for. There may be such goals, but if they can't help seeking for them, they aren't free. There are values which we wish to realize in our lives. These values, for Kant, are not stars in some external heaven, some objective entities which a competent philosopher can discern and describe as he describes animal or mineral species. What happens is that a man determines himself. A man freely chooses or commits himself to choosing certain values. We choose, we are not chosen for. And the morality of the act consists in the act of commitment. So the notion of commitment, the notion that the whole value of a moral act consists in the fact that a man freely commits himself to pursue a certain kind of life or to perform a certain kind of act, really begins its serious career under Kant. It's not the value which the man chooses which makes the act moral. It's the choosing of it. Still less the consequence. The consequences we can't control. Consequences we can't tell about. Therefore, what is the use of telling men to be utilitarians when in fact it simply reduces them once again to some kind of mechanical toys, so to speak, of nature herself? Nature may be ever so benevolent and ever so nice and ever so well, so to speak, kindly and so on, but if we are simply playthings in our hands, morality for Kant disappears. And he suffers from an almost paranoid fear of being locked up in a kind of terrible natural cage of rigorous determinist causation in which you, so to speak, from which you can't shake yourself free. And this to him is in some sense, falsification of human nature. This is the heart and center of Kant's actual moral doctrine. He sometimes qualifies it, he tries to get out of the dilemma in various ways, but he always, always returns to this one central point. Therefore, for Kant, men are value choosers, and they are ends in themselves in this sense. What is meant by saying a man is all men are ends in themselves, as he says? What it means is that if you are going to sacrifice a man to something, you must sacrifice him to something higher than himself. For example, the state. For example, to God. for example, to the progress of culture, or the progress of history, or the progress of your race, or your nation, or your church. But, says Kant, nothing is higher than man. It's no good saying that the nation, or the state, or even God, is a value which in some way is higher than that of man, because since to be a value is to be chosen by man, the very act of valuation is what makes a value, in a certain sense, you determine your values. If you don't invent them or create them, at least it's the choosing of them, it's the adhering to them which makes acts valuable or valueless. If it is that, there is nothing higher to which men can be sacrificed because they are the authors of values. Therefore, to sacrifice a man to something which is not himself is to degrade him, exploit him, in some way to commit a sin against the Holy Ghost, to do the most immoral thing which you can possibly do. Hence this constant insistence on the fact that you mustn't use men as means to ends, but only as ends in themselves. That's the meaning of that formula. You mustn't use men as means to ends, no matter how splendid, because they must choose them themselves. If they don't choose these ends themselves, they become playthings. If they become playthings, they are dehumanized, and that is a crime and a sin. And that is the heart, as I say, of Kant's moral doctrine. He didn't directly apply it to politics. Nevertheless, it, of course, did have its political implications. The notion of nature, therefore, becomes, as you can see, no longer that of a model or something to follow, which it is for almost the entire 18th century. Nature now becomes the stuff on which you wreak your will. It becomes a kind of indifferent stuff, a kind of slag heap with which you do what you like. At worst, it's an enemy. It's an enemy because the more natural you are, the more animal you are. It's in a way the recrudescence in secular terms of the old Christian opposition between matter and grace, between nature and grace. Nature is what seeks always to kill you. Nature is what wants to, so to speak, turn you into something causal. Nature is your body. Nature are all those forces which you can do very little about. Nature is the inexorable, the inevitable, the determined. You, man, moral beings, the moral author, is not inexorable, not determined, you are free. And therefore nature is now conceived of, at best, as neutral stuff upon which you wreak your free will, at worst, as an enemy seeking in some way to enslave you. And this is new. The idea of hostility to nature is something which the French could never have accepted and would have regarded, I think, as a little insane. But certainly Kant sets this doctrine going, of the self versus nature, self versus the world, and not in a certain sense as part of that great world which the sciences can explain and which the sciences can, in a sense, give you authority over, give you power over. Hence, the very idea of a science of man, be it anthropology, sociology, psychology, no matter what, is for Kant simply the science of the non human parts of man, his nervous system, his emotions, his passions, all the things which Herder thought he shouldn't have isolated or divided from the rest of man. Certainly there can be a science of human passions, there can be a science of psychology, but this merely deals with a poor old empirical body. But there is something beyond this, there is the immortal soul, and of the immortal soul there cannot be a science, because it's free. If it's free, it obeys no laws. It only obeys the laws which you set for yourself. But laws which you set for yourself are not inevitable. You needn't set them for yourself. This he also derives from Rousseau. And let me make an aside here. This is typical of the modern world. You see, there is a great break somewhere in the 17th century between the view by which validity, truth, is something which is resident out there. Only those things which are true, for which you can claim that they exist in the external world, whether you want it so or not. That's what makes things true. That's what makes arguments valid. If there are laws out there created by nature or by God, that is, so to speak, the nature of things. And that's what makes things true. In the 17th century, as a result of the rise of subjectivism for various causes and reasons, which I'm afraid I can't discuss here, you get a reversal of this. Only those things are valid, only those things are true, which you make for yourself, in a certain sense. Only those laws are real, which we impose upon yourself. Laws are now no longer laws in the natural sense of simply generalizations about what happens in the world. Laws now are rules. Rules need authors. The author is myself. And therefore, from the middle of the, roughly, from the beginning perhaps, of the 17th century onwards, under the influence of both of Descartes and of Grotius, you get the notion that if a man obeys laws made by some outside force, he is a slave. If he obeys laws made by himself, he is free. He is free because he can shake them off. He is free because they are of his own making. Now, Kant was rationalist enough, and enough of a child of the Enlightenment, and he was far more so than Herder in some ways, to believe that there was a thing, faculty called reason. And therefore, all men who ask themselves what is right and what is wrong, because they're rational, will arrive at the same conclusions. He didn't give very many clear tips about how to discover what in fact is rational, and it remains obscure in his works, and it remains obscure in any case. The notion of what rational ends are is one of the obscurest problems of philosophy. 30 years ago, I thought I could understand it, but with the as a result of growing age, I've become denser and denser on this subject, I have to tell you, and no longer quite understand what rational ends are. At least Kant thought he did, but he doesn't make it very clear what they are. At any rate, the point is that he did believe that all men are rational creatures, and what is right for one man will, if he thinks in correct ways, will be equally right for another man. And therefore there need be no conflict. There will not be a situation in which something is right for me, which is incompatible with something which is right for you. He thinks there is some kind of natural harmony or coincidence because reason is the same in all men. This is the concession which he does make to rationalism. But this is not the part of Kant which affected subsequent thought. At least it didn't affect it as strongly as the elements on which I am trying to concentrate. What really affected later thought was the notion that I must be my own author. Autonomy. I am the author of my acts. Consequently, you get the notion that what you have to work for is not happiness, not efficiency, above all, not a world in which a lot of Helvetian or Holbachian wiseacres, a lot of scientists or a lot of enlightened despots manipulate the human herd even for their own good, because this is in some way a degrading spectacle. What you have to work for is human dignity and the humanity in man, so to speak. Human dignity, freedom, respect for other people. Respect for other people as it were, valuers, as choosers. They're choosers in exactly the same way as you are a chooser. And you mustn't choose for them, you must let them choose for themselves, even if what they choose is wrong. As I say, he profoundly believed that to choose wrongly is better than not to choose at all, because that is the essence of man. I imagine the worst possible kind of philosopher from his point of view would have been someone like Jeremy Bentham, who believed that that all that was necessary was to create a society in which men were induced by self-interest to do things which in fact would make other people happy. Since they couldn't do it in the light of their own reason, or evidently haven't, you must create a society in which there are strong inducements for them to act in such a way as to make society harmonious, efficient, and happy. This, for Kant, as I say, is ultimate degradation of the whole of human nature. And particularly the Bentham, who talked about human rights, which for Kant was absolutely sacred, the right, human rights simply reside in the fact that they are free choosers. That is what is meant by saying they have rights, that they are human. Bentham, who said that rights were nonsense, and the idea of natural rights was nonsense on stilts, mere bawling on paper, he said to the French revolutionaries, who made him an honorary citizen. Kant was among the few philosophers of his day who approved of the French Revolution, not only of the early stages of it, which everybody was very pleased about, but even of the later stages when the terror began and when most respectable persons naturally were horrified and began to curse it. And he approved of it because he thought that for the first time a constitution was promulgated in which at least in theory every man was able to vote in accordance with his own impulses, or not impulses so much, in accordance with his own moral will. They might be wrong, but at least it was recognized that they were not to be dominated by other men, no matter who, whether clerics or secular, whether enlightened tyrants or any other wise oligarchy of men, but were allowed to choose the form of government for themselves by a free act of voting. And this appeared to him to be a colossal triumph in favor of what might be called the moral dignity of men. And that is why he remained a friend of the French Revolution from the beginning to the end of his life. It wasn't a very popular thing to do in Prussia, and he kept rather quiet about it. In fact, he was he received a warning. He received a veiled, but nevertheless fairly firm warning from Frederick the Great's nephew, who succeeded him on the throne, that even though he was a quiet professor of logic at Königsberg, it didn't really do for him to propagate dangerous thoughts of this kind, and he piped down on the whole. But he didn't change his opinions. His writings still betray this rather wistful admiration for these heroic figures in Paris, no matter how violent, how bloodstained, which is a rather remarkable fact about this very quiet man who was born in Königsberg, never left it, and is otherwise a model of a quiet, decent, respectable provincial professor. Let me now say a few words about his disciple, the dramatist Schiller, who I think has also formed a kind of link in the particular succession which I'm trying to trace. Schiller is constantly talking about freedom, and he's talking about freedom in constants. He talks about the kingdom of freedom, free principle in man, spiritual freedom, mankind through sacred palladium is freedom, inner freedom, moral freedom, the free mind, the independent principle in us, holy freedom, which is our true fatherland, demonic freedom, and all kinds of phrases of that sort. He's absolutely intoxicated with the mere word freedom, so to speak, which somehow means everything to him and means somehow or other the power of resistance against the evil forces of nature. That's what it really does mean. The thing which he opposes to freedom, the other side, is something called the compulsion of nature, blind natural necessity, the forces of nature, like emotions or instincts, as well as physical forces. It is not for man, as for other creatures, to reflect the rays of some other rational being, says Schiller. Not even those of the divine being himself. He must shine by his own light. And then something even more daring. Not even the Almighty can end our autonomy. Not even he determines our will against our principles, good or bad, virtuous or vicious. All other things must. Man alone wills. He is subject to laws neither of nature nor of reason. Of course he ought to be reasonable if he can be, but he's not subject to the laws of reason. If he chooses to be rational, so much the worse for him, but he can. That is the point. Nature gets off very badly in Schiller. Nature, he says, treads in the dust the creations of wisdom. Significant and trivial, noble and base, she involves them all in the same hideous disaster. She preserves some unimportant world of ants, but man, her most glorious creature, she crushes in her giant's arm in one frivolous hour. That's so much for nature, red in tooth and claw. It really begins then. And of course, men seek servitude. They seek slavery, but they mustn't be allowed it. You might say that men might be happier as slaves. Perhaps they are contented slaves. They can be drugged into it. They can be hypnotized into it. It may be that men don't want to lose their chains. But, echoing Rousseau, he says, if they love their chains, they must be shamed into throwing them off. They've no business to love their chains. Happiness is not enough. A man who grovels upon the ground bound with chains, strewn with flowers, as Rousseau says, and says he is perfectly comfortable in them, and doesn't at least wish to be liberated, betrays his true nature. He has no business to be in chains. He must be liberated, no matter how much he struggles against it. This is certainly the doctrine. Phaeton, said Schiller by the mythological son of Apollo, Phaeton drove Apollo's horses wildly to his disaster, but he drove them, he was not driven. I may tell you, it wasn't only Schiller who said these things. This became quite a prevalent mood towards the end of the 18th century. The poet Blake, who was a Swedenborgian, says something very similar to that. He also has a kind of superstitious fear of being in a kind of, some kind of scientific cage, of being caged in some kind of hideous, determinist, causal universe in which he can't act as a free human being. When, in the famous poem, he says, Robin Redbreast in a cage sets all heaven in a rage, let me tell you that the cage of which he speaks is the cage of scientific rationalism, not a literal cage. And the villains of the piece are Newton and Locke. These are the people who have bound chains upon human beings and have prevented their freedom. Laws are needed to fence men off, and their children wept and built tombs in desolate places, and formed laws of prudence, and called them the eternal laws of God. It says, art is the tree of life. Science is the tree of death. You can't go much further than that. And this, on the whole, indicates, so to speak, that already towards the end of the 18th century, there began this quite intelligible, if irrational, struggle against, indignation with, what was regarded as over-tidy, spick-and-span universe in which human beings were somehow like bricks in some noble edifice, mere bricks, unable to get out. Even Diderot, who I suppose was an encyclopedist of encyclopedists, after all, he was the editor of the encyclopedia, and in a way, an absolutely characteristic philosopher of the 18th century, speaks of the nearness of the great artist to the great criminal. And he says, they both break rules. They both are in love with splendor and with power. They both take dreadful risks. They defy conventions. Farouche and savage inside, they create. The artist creates marvelous, new, original, bold, upsetting art. And the criminal commits huge crimes. He doesn't approve of the criminal, but he thinks these are the people who move mankind and not the more conventional figures who are merely talented, merely respectable. I don't think Diderot says this quite at all often. I mean, normally he takes a perfectly ordinary conventional encyclopedist line, but the mere fact that in the middle of the 18th century such things could be said is an indication of the fact that a kind of dark revolt against what might be called sheer rationalism, sheer encyclopedism, this whole sort of edifice of Newtonianized world in which morals and politics, our social lives, individual lives, will be regulated in accordance with the new laws of psychology and sociology, which will be discovered by scientists, is beginning to brew. Take Kant's view of punishment. It would be regarded as a highly reactionary view of punishment, but it's perfectly characteristic of him. Kant believes in retributive punishment, not corrective punishment, not punishment which is education, and not punishment which is merely preventive and merely protects the peaceful from the criminal. He believes in retribution because he thinks men are responsible for their acts. And if they're responsible, then they must be punished because they're responsible. If you take a man who is a criminal and you say, the poor creature couldn't help himself. He is not a thief, he's a kleptomaniac. He's not a murderer, he's a man who's been badly educated and this appeared to him a good thing to do. He didn't know any better. And therefore he ought to be sent to be cured, he ought to be sent to hospital, which is a perfectly humane modern view, for example. For Kant, this is an insult to him, to the criminal. The criminal is a free being, and he would prefer to go to prison in order to pay the price of this, because he knew what he was doing, instead of being regarded as a poor thing, inferior to the people who are sending him to hospital. The one thing which he doesn't want, and this is a perfectly intelligible attitude, the one thing which he doesn't want is to be regarded as a creature inferior to the scientists who judge him, to the doctors who send him. He'd rather be a free criminal who knows what price he's going to pay, and if necessary, pays it, than a rather inferior creature who has to be pitied, who has to be well-treated by people who are compassionate towards him because they're superior to him. They understand his motives, whereas he does not. They are the psychiatrists, he is the patient. This, for Kant, is the ultimate insult to human nature, and it is for Schiller, too. And this is a perfectly intelligible attitude, and this is why Kant holds on rather strongly to what even in his day was a not particularly popular view of retributive punishment. Because at least it recognizes human responsibility to the fullest and allows that a man knows what he's doing as opposed to not knowing it. Now, to go back to Schiller for a moment, let me give you an example of the kind of thing Schiller said, and you will see how this leads to the ultimate irrationalist assault. Schiller is, of course, a dramatist, and he's interested in the theory of the drama. And he is discussing the play, The Medea, which I don't think it's actually Euripides' Medea. It's the Medea, I think, of written in the 17th century. I think it's Corneille's Medea, in fact, he's talking about. And everybody here, I'm sure, knows the story of Medea. Medea is the daughter of the king of Colchis. Jason arrives from Athens in pursuit of the Argonauts, in pursuit of the Golden Fleece. He falls in love with Medea. He abducts her by her own wish. He marries her. He sails off with the Golden Fleece. Then being an ordinary sort of Thracian or Athenian, it's not quite certain which, he abandons her for another woman. Medea is indignant, enraged in fact, and proceeds to murder the children whom she bore for Jason. In some stories she merely strangles them, in other stories she boils them alive. Now, Schiller doesn't approve the act of boiling alive. He doesn't say that it was a particularly good thing to have done. That he does not say. But he says there would have been no tragedy if Medea were not a heroine. And she's a heroine because she rises above nature. By nature, she's a mother. By nature, she has a maternal instinct. By nature, she ought to love her children, being capable of this act. And nature is what would compel an ordinary woman, not to do this. But she rises above nature in a monstrous way, no doubt. In a savage, monstrous, and sinister way. She resists natural impulse and dominates her own nature to such a degree that she actually puts her children to death, which is unnatural and contra-natural fact. And this makes Medea a very sizable figure. And that's what makes her a tragic heroine. If she didn't do that, if she simply obeyed her impulses, there would be nothing interesting about her. Compare her, he says, to Jason, who is a perfectly nice man, doesn't kill anybody at all, just an ordinary, middle-class Athenian, as it were, an ordinary bourgeois Athenian, floating down the ordinary river of life, obeys ordinary conventions, just keeps a mistress, I mean, this is not unknown, and so forth. This is a perfectly ordinary man, so to speak, of no size at all. And he, therefore, doesn't in any sense form a tragic hero. Whereas Medea, the whole tragedy is there because Medea is superhuman, because she's of monstrous size. And anybody who can resist nature in that way is fully human, even though she uses her freedom in a very abominable and wicked way. But better, she at least is a proof of the existence of freedom. That's what Medea means to him. Exactly the same thing happens in the play called The Robbers. The Räuber, where Karl Moor, who's a man who is wounded by society, proceeds to become a criminal and performs various crimes against his own wife, indeed, and against various other persons, until in the end he hands himself over to the police. But before he does that, the point is that previously to that, the whole notion of tragedy is that it's due to some sort of mistake. If you understood the nature of reality, you wouldn't need to act in this way. If Oedipus had known that Laios was his father, he wouldn't have killed him and all would have been well. If Antigone had understood what was what, she would have acted in some manner which wouldn't have involved her in the particular fate in which she was involved. Therefore, ultimately, it's ignorance. Maybe the gods send this ignorance on you, maybe you can't help it, in which case it's very sad. But omniscient beings couldn't possibly be involved in tragedy. They would be harmonious, they would be happy. All tragedy is due to some kind of misunderstanding of what's what, of what nature is like, of what means to lead to what ends, of what truly makes people happy and what doesn't. This is no longer true for someone like Schiller. In the case of Medea, in the case of Karl Moor, values have clashed. Karl Moor, the society is no doubt evil and needn't be, but Karl Moor is a heroic, demonic figure, between whom violent ends struggle. He can't quite make up his mind between them. But he's perfectly free to choose, and whichever ends he chooses, whether he chooses to obey the law, or whether he chooses to defy it, something terrible will happen. If he chooses to obey the law, he will kill the impulse to freedom inside him. If he chooses to disobey it, he will make a lot of people miserable and commit various crimes. There is no solution to Karl Moor's problem, because not all values are compatible. This is the first moment at which you begin the break in the third proposition, on which the third leg of the tripod, in which I spoke about in my first lecture, namely that all true answers to problems of behavior must be compatible with each other and form a kind of jigsaw puzzle. But if man is free, and free to do evil as well as good, and if man has more than one choice, perhaps three or four alternatives, three or four possibilities on which he can embark, if some of these possibilities are not compatible with possibilities chosen by others, then tragedy is built into the very nature of reality. Anything, however, is better than being mere cog in some kind of machine. That is one thing which is not permissible. The enemies, as I say, are, of course, as I say, Newton and Locke. And he distinguishes Schiller between what is tragedy? Leocon. Leocon is a man who knows that if he tells the truth to the Trojans about the Greeks, the snakes, the dragons, will strangle him. And he does tell the truth, but he needn't have done. He chooses to do it because he defies what he knows to be his fate. And the fact that these snakes strangle him is evil. He couldn't have escaped it. Nothing which Laocoon could have done could have made him happy, so to speak. And he chooses heroically. Regulus, who hands himself over to the Romans, to the Carthaginians, because he promised to go back, performed the heroic act which he knows is going to end in a most ghastly disaster for him. And he cannot avoid it, do what he might. Satan, in Milton's poem, has seen all the horrors of hell, nevertheless he goes on with his evil practices. And although this may be monstrous, it's heroic, it's dynamic, it's in some way free. Whereas Iago or Richard III in Shakespeare are not tragic figures. They are simply human beings entirely determined by passions. Passions are parts of nature. And therefore we watch them simply like animals. They are clever animals who are trying to gain their ends in the way in which cats or dogs or tigers might. And therefore they don't stir pity and they don't stir horror. They're simply creatures of their own passions, not free and therefore contemptible. And therefore there is a difference between resisting nature and following her, whether what you do is good or what you do is evil. To be driven by passion is certainly a form of heteronomy, what later came to be called alienation. The enemy is always coercion, whether it's coercion by nature on the one hand, or whether it's coercion by the state, let us say, on the other. This, I think, is the Kantian heritage in Schiller, this perpetual harping on freedom, even if freedom takes demonic or monstrous forms. And later, of course, you will find it among the heroes of the German Romantics, among these Byronic individuals, so to speak, who dominate their environment, even though they dominate it in a very sinister and hideous fashion. And this really derives, that is the proposition I wish to reiterate, from Kant's insistence, his obstinate, constant refrain, you see, upon the fact that the most important thing about man is his will, not his reason, his will, because that is alone what frees him from nature and makes him into a creature who can determine his own fate. A man whose will is broken is no man. A man may be irrational, he's still a man, but a man whose will is broken has ceased to be a man. And so we have this highly rigorous, quiet, rational, above all, scientifically inclined, logically coherent thinker who, because of his, perhaps because of his extreme obsession, if you like, with trying to escape what he regards as the prison of determinism, because of his grappling with the problem of free will, invents the notion of the free ego, or the free self. Now, in my next lecture, I propose to tell you about how Fichte, who in some sense was a kind of treacherous disciple of Kant, that is to say, a man who claimed to be a disciple of Kant, but whom Kant regarded with absolute horror, how Fichte developed this idea, partly out of Kant, partly out of Herder, partly out of Schiller himself, into a vast moral and political doctrine, which thereafter proceeded to dominate both German and non-German thought, and created a great many of the movements, as I say, by which our own time is dominated. Fichte is really, if you like to call him so, the villain of this particular piece. And it is really he who socializes, politicizes, publicizes this whole thing, and the career of Fichte, who begins as an extreme romantic individualist and ends as a man who sings immense paeans to the power of the powerful, organic, all-embracing state and all-embracing nation. The career of how a man begins with these Kantian beginnings and ends with something which resembles some of the most intoxicating and sinister doctrines of the 20th century is, I think, a story which I, at any rate, regard as worth telling. Thank you very much.